Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Lawrence C. Smith. He is the John Atwater and Diana Nelson University Professor of Environmental Studies and Professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at Brown University. And we're talking about his new book, Rivers of Power: How a Natural Force Raised Kingdoms, Destroyed Civilizations, and Shapes Our World.
Thanks.
Lawrence, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk about this book.
I'm very glad to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
The great thing is, this is like two books in one. You get the reader will get two books. The first, like third of the book, maybe, you literally rewrite the history of Earth seen through the lens of rivers. I mean, you go way, way back. You go back 4.4 billion years. And it's amazing when you do this exercise because it really, in the for the reader, it really emphasizes how important rivers were in our history.
Well, yeah, they certainly have been around a very long time. You know, soon after the origins of the Earth itself, the first clouds began to form and rains began to fall. We'll never know their chemistry very well, of course. But those early rainfalls set up an eternal battle between two great global forces, plate tectonics and erosion, which are fighting for supremacy over the shape of the planet's surface. And that battle will roll on for several more billion years until our dying, expanding sun boils away every drop into steam. Okay.
Now, what was amazing to me is how many things, pieces of history, that rivers play prominent roles in. And there's some important things that everybody should know about the Opium Wars and Yangtze River, Vietnam War, and the Mekong River, the Mississippi River flood in 1927. And people, I'm skipping over this because there's other parts of this book that I really want to talk about. But I guess just as an example of history seen through how rivers have been used and abused, I want to talk about the rise of Communist China and Chiang Kai-shek and the Huang He or the Yellow River. There's a fascinating thing that happens in 1938 when the river is diverted that literally changed the course of history in China.
I'm really glad that you found that story to pick up on because so many people don't know about this incredible thing that happened in 1938 when Chiang Kai-shek, then the leader of China, did something terrible to the Yellow River and his own people, which I argue helped, and others helped to bring about not only his own downfall, but it forever changed the course of political power in mainland China. And this is a time in history that many Americans, and including myself, in fact, before I started researching this book, don't know much about. It's a time when during the run-up to World War II, when Japan was basically invading parts of China and creating some horrible atrocities there. And in 1938, the Japanese Imperial Army was advancing on Chinese forces, which China had been distracted with its own civil war prior to the invasion by Japan, with Chiang Kai-shek fighting the communists, and Chiang Kai-shek had Western support. But the communists and the nationalists agreed to put that civil war on hold while they both turned and faced this common enemy, the Imperialist Army of Japan. And Japan was advancing on Wuhan, which was the new capital that China had retreated into Wuhan, and Kai-shek was desperate to halt this advance. And the way he did it, I couldn't believe it.
I couldn't believe it either. was like, I obviously didn't know this history before, and my jaw dropped.
Yeah, he deliberately blew the levees on the Yellow River, which is an extremely dangerous river anyway, for reasons we can get into, geological reasons we can get into if you want. But basically, this is a wild river that not infrequently switches its course and sometimes flows to the north of the country, sometimes to the south. It's a very dangerous river that's prone to flooding and avulsion. River avulsions are when a river will not only flood but actually leap out of its path and start carving a new path to someplace else. And Chiang Kai-shek triggered one of these by blasting the levees on the Yellow River to divert it into the path of the oncoming army. And
okay, and all well and good in that respect, but what else? What happened?
Well, he drowned nearly a million Chinese. He wiped out 3,500 villages of his own people. Many cities just simply disappeared.
He gave them no warning.
None. He just did this, and it did temporarily halt the advance of the Japanese army. And
temporary is the key word there.
Yeah, but the biggest impact was actually a domestic one, and the river no longer was in its own old valley flowing to the north. It was carving out a new one flowing to the south, and all the people that lived along the old river valley found their boats dry and their fishing villages, you know, unlivable. And to the south, people were drowning and getting flooded, and the river continued to flood every year as it tried to stabilize itself. And what's interesting is into this void entered the communists spent a lot of time resettling these misplaced peoples and developing developing favor with them and standing up for the people. And this, the story goes on to where Chiang Kai-shek decided to divert it back into the old channel after a while, where people were now living, and wanted to do that without warning. And all of this, go ahead.
So by flood relief, by the communist Chinese aiding in flood relief, they obviously won the hearts and minds of people.
They did. And it actually, so much so that it actually went on to become a prime recruiting ground for Mao to recruit fighters into the Communist Revolutionary Army. And so after World War II ended and the Japanese were kicked out, that civil war resumed. And thanks in part to the recruitment value that this horrible event had on the Chinese people, that led to a series of events that ended up with Chiang Kai-shek being kicked out to Taiwan and Mao taking over China and setting up a communist rule, which persists to this day.
And so this first section of the book, which is amazing to read, really brings home the point: the rivers in human society, it's been a source of warfare, political boundaries, a source of food and power. The list goes on. Societies have built themselves along the banks of rivers. When we come to more modern times, the late 20th and then the 21st century, the story gets very, very serious because we have so many more people, we have all these projects that we're designing to use the river. And I want to give an example. There are things, river diversions and mega dams. First of all, what's a river diversion?
A river diversion is one of the oldest human inventions around. They were invented at least 9,000 BC in the mountains of Syria. And the concept is simple. If you have a stream or a river, you dig a side ditch to try to route some water off to the side to irrigate crops, for example. And we've been doing this since the dawn of agricultural civilization, but we're now taking it to a whole new scale where we're essentially replumbing entire continents to divert river water from one part of the continent to another. And this began in a big way in the 1930s, and with big ideas coming out of the state of California, which now diverts much of its water from the north of the state to the south of the state, and is underway at this very moment on a much grander scale in China, and potentially India and sub-Saharan Africa.
Now, I want to ask you about the GERD, which stands for the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Now, what's fascinating to me is, as you bring forth in the beginning part of the book, obviously the Nile River has been of crucial importance to the development and evolution of the ancient Egyptian culture and societies. But today, we have a potential source of warfare or conflict in the damming of the river. Talk to me about this.
Yeah, sure. This is a fascinating story, and one of the that's happening at this very moment on one of the oldest and most historically significant rivers in all of human civilization, which is, of course, the Nile River, which flows through present-day Cairo and allowed the origins of ancient Egyptian culture, which flourished for 3,000 years along its riverbanks. Well, the biggest tributary to the Nile is the Blue Nile River, which drains off the Ethiopian highlands, where the vast majority of water in the Nile comes from. And Ethiopia is at this moment building a massive dam across the Blue Nile. And Egypt is rather understandably freaking out because the water from the Nile is essential for human existence in Cairo and Lower Egypt.
It's still that way.
It still is. Oh, absolutely. I mean, without that water, Egypt could not exist. And in fact, there are many cities around the world that are in that same boat, which is what makes some of the modern challenges facing river water and you know, water supply more generally so challenging.
If the Blue Nile is dammed, what is going to be the effect downriver in Egypt?
Well, if Ethiopia wished, they could essentially shut off most of the water to Egypt, especially during the reservoir infilling time, because this reservoir is so enormous that it could swallow up the entire flow of the Blue Nile for several years while it filled. That won't happen, of course. I mean, Ethiopia and Egypt have been in very testy exchanges over this. Egypt, in fact, tried to sabotage the project, and this is where it becomes quite interesting, because early I actually interviewed a number of people who were involved with the obtaining of the funding and planning for this dam, which is relatively new project. And they originally applied for conventional internationally funding measures through the World Bank and a number of sovereign national wealth funds. And Egypt lobbied hard behind the scenes to shut down all of those conventional sources of international funding. So Ethiopia rose to the challenge in a very interesting way, where they said, fine, you know, to heck with all of you, the world, and we will fund this ourselves. And it's a very expensive project and, a huge burden for the government to take on. It has a small economy. But, you know, government employees are expected to donate a month of their salary. There is a whole...
Now, that's amazing that they could expect that. But what's happened is this project now has become a source of national pride.
That's exactly right. And not only within Ethiopia, where people... now travel to this far corner of the country on the anniversary of the groundbreaking to celebrate it, but also throughout the global Ethiopian diaspora, where bonds, which can be purchased for as little as a few dollars, are being sold to support the building of this dam and are restricted to Ethiopian nationals. I actually tried to buy a bond just for fun. I thought it'd be a cool thing to have, and I was, learned that I was ineligible to purchase one. So it has become a source of great national pride for Ethiopia as it, is becoming a rising power in the region.
What's incredible reading your book is of all the big, huge, mega projects involving rivers. In China, there's the South to North Diversion Project. In Africa, there's the Trans-Aqua, which has to do with the Congo River and the Chari River Basin. In India, the National River Linking Project, the Three Gorges Dam, which generates power. But in every one of these mega projects, one of the questions you ask is, who benefits and what is lost? And oftentimes, it's lower-income local peoples who live along the river who are going to lose tremendously, not to mention the ecosystem of the river is going to be totally forever changed. And what about the power, like the Three Gorges Dam? Who gets to use the power?
No, that's a really great point. And it's one that's often overlooked by people if you listen casually to the boosters of these projects. For example, you named the big ones. And if we just return for a moment back to the GERD, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. You know, as I spoke to people, a common thread in my interviews with these boosters was they would talk about how few people in Ethiopia have electricity and how the dam was going to generate all this electricity.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And left hanging in the air was somehow, you know, I was sort of left to assume that, oh, this electricity would go to the poor people, the rural poor who don't have it. But in fact, nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, the real plan is to sell the electricity to Sudan and downstream. And the rural poor who are living along its valley will be forcibly relocated and removed. They can't live under a reservoir. And if anything, it forces more rural poor to move to the cities because they've been dislocated. The project is generating money, which is pumped into the cities, and does very little for the rural poor who don't have it. So yes, it's kind of a sad repeated story we see again and again in all walks of human society, where it's often the have-nots that suffer the most.
Okay, putting aside that section, which is huge and very, very important, you also then talk about there's a trend to eliminate dams. In some places, I know that they were thinking about that here along the Blackstone River in Worcester, which was once an incredibly polluted river.
Yes. Yep.
What are the problems with just taking a dam out?
The problems with taking a big dam out are, happily, as we've learned over the last 10 to 15 years, less horrible than river scientists feared. Keep in mind, in the United States and in Europe, many of our big dams and small dams are well over 100 years old, if not more. Many of them have outlived their useful purpose for which they were designed. They have infilled with sediment. They have low water.
That's what's happened here. That's what's happened here in the Blackstone.
Oh yes. In fact, all of New England. New England is just, as you well know, and your listeners well know, this is a fascinating experiment in land use change that happened first with the damming of thousands of small dams, flowhead dams across the rivers of this area and streams for mills, the cutting of forests, and now the reforestation and the gradual removal of many of these dams. And dam removal is very popular right now in the American upper Midwest and on the West Coast, where the new trend is taking these structures down. And the big fears with that, well, for example, the trapped sediment behind the dam would smother the river downstream, that fish would never return. But in fact, through a number of careful disassembly experiments that have been taking place over the last decade, we're learning that rivers and fish are wonderfully resilient and are able to rebound with amazing speed if these disassemblies or deconstructions are done right. And so it's a real happy story where and keep in mind, it's a small number in the grand scheme of things, but the trend in the United States and Europe is to take down dams, whereas in the developing world, it's to build them even bigger than before.
There's also, and you write extensively about this, people are experimenting with ways of lessening a dam's damage with things like designer flows, run-of-the-river dams, and sediment pass-through technologies. Talk about those.
Oh, yes. This the dams being built today, fortunately, are not are being looked at in at least slightly different light, at least in many environments, than, say, you know, the Hoover Dam, which towers, and it becomes impossible for fish to pass, and impossible for boats to pass upstream or downstream, impossible for sediments to move downstream, which is really the number one number one job that rivers do, which is to move their sediment downstream. And dams interrupt that, particularly very large ones. And at this moment, there is tremendous pressure to build big dams across the lower Mekong River in Southeast Asia. And if dams were built there that had this type of sediment trapping capability, it would all but force the lower part of the delta to disintegrate into the sea, because coastal erosion is always attacking that delta. This is the Mekong River Delta, where many American soldiers fought during the Vietnam War, and amongst the waterways of that delta. That exists because of the constant delivery of fresh sediment from upstream to replace what's being eroded away by the ocean. So if the Southeast Asian countries and China were to build huge dams that trap sediment, that delta would be doomed. So some of the new technologies that you described, in particular sediment pass-through technologies, are looking at ways of building dams that have lower heads, don't trap as much water, and most importantly, allow some of the sediment at least to flow around or under the dam to keep it moving downstream. I hope it goes this route because the region is under tremendous pressure to develop, and it would be quite catastrophic for both the environment and people who live along these waterways downstream if we don't learn from some of the mistakes of the past.
Now, we could talk about so much more in this book because there's a lot in here, but you have an interesting thing where you describe your worst field experience that you've had to do. Talk to me about that.
Yeah.
That was like, that looked like that was something out of hell.
Yeah, it was pretty nasty. This was for my master's degree in earth sciences at the Indiana University. And southern Indiana, like many parts of America, were big coal mining districts during the coal boom. And in the 30s, when this particular area was developed, it was done by strip mining. So that the coal seam ran near to the earth's surface, and it would be sort of just scooped out with excavators and blasting, and the coal would be stripped out, and the refuse, the leftover shale, which is full of pyrite and other easily oxidized minerals, is heaped up to, you know, lay out in the rain. And as water percolates through this stuff, it dissolves these minerals, and out comes an acidic sludge, orange and yellow, that chokes the streams and rivers and kills everything in it. And I was a new graduate student, and my advisor suggested a really neat project would be to go stand in one of these gullies during storms to study erosion and chemistry as these flash floods came washing down. And all of them happened in the middle of the night. My hands got chapped and stained with low pH water and turned orange.
Oh, my God.
And I soaked no matter what. And to this day, I still dislike the rain.
I just had this picture of you with lightning flashes in the background, standing in this acidic water, trying to take dead water samples.
The storms always seem to happen in the dead of night, and I would drive to the site in a state of Indiana SUV, sleep on top of the truck so the first raindrop hit the face and wake me up, and it was quite hellish. Yeah, but you know, it marked that site is now. Much more successfully reclaimed than when I did my master's degree.
Nice.
And this was in the late 90s when I did that, or early 90s when I did that work. And there has been great progress thanks to work of the EPA set in motion by, of all people, Republican President Nixon, who was a real progressive when it came to in the environment. And, you know, set in motion a number of cleanup activities that have greatly improved the cleanliness of our waterways in the United States.
Although
the early 70s.
That's all going by the wayside right now.
Yes. The current EPA is, or the current administration's, also Republican, of course, perspective on the EPA couldn't be more different and more diametrically opposed than that of the 1970s Republican Party. And it has been a real stripping and undermining and reversal of many water quality measures meant to protect our waterways, beginning first with the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who was really in the public eye because he was just doing all kinds of really ethically incomprehensible things. But more adeptly by his successor, who is managing to stay out of the scandals, but is still caring for it, many of the same policies.
We just have a few minutes left, but I want to talk. What was amazing for me to read is there's somewhat of an attempt to renew the Los Angeles River.
There is.
And by the way, if people out there have ever seen it, it's not really a river anymore. It's sort of like a cement gully.
It's a cement gully. You see it in lots of cool movies. You know, people are always drag racing and putting graffiti art on the sides. It's a really neat piece of urban lore. but there is not just a plan, but I mean a real plan with billions of dollars at stake in a partnership between the state and the California and the city of Los Angeles and the U.S. government through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. To return this river, to remove the concrete liner, and to return this river to a state of some ecological functioning. I don't want to oversell it, but also, perhaps most significantly, as a place of green space and for a space of parks and green space and publicly available beautiful areas for urban people to enjoy. And this is it's actually a subject I sort of end the book on, with this an amazing renaissance that has been underway over the last 15 years. We're seeing it along major urban riverfronts all over the world.
We're seeing it here with the Blackstone River, too.
Absolutely. The revival of our riverfronts and the restoration of them to really wonderful public spaces with parks and, you know, stores and condominiums. And it marks a wonderful return of people back to the riverfronts after being cut off from them for so long, really since the big dam building era and the began in the 1930s.
And finally, I just want to mention one person I never heard of before, and I'm glad you wrote about him, Mina Gulley or Gulley?
Yeah, she's a really Mina Gulley is a really interesting water activist and a ultra marathon runner. She runs marathons one after the other, and a few years back, she to raise awareness about the environmental problems facing many rivers, she ran a marathon alongside the banks of a number of our great rivers, and she'd run one and then fly to the next river and run another and fly to the next river and run another. And at the end of her period, as I recall, she ran 40 marathons in 40 days along the many of the world's great rivers. And she's still out there carrying out these activist projects and fundraising today.
There is so much in this book. I really want to emphasize that to the audience. And it's an enjoyable book to read. My guest tonight has been Lawrence C. Smith. He's the John Atwater and Diana Nelson University Professor of Environmental Studies and Professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at Brown University. That's a lot of territory. We're talking about his new book, Rivers of Power, How a Natural Force Raised Kingdoms, Destroyed Civilizations, and Shapes Our World. Lawrence, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thanks so much, Mark.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.